I don't know. It sounds like a porn.
It does sound like a porn.
Hi.
It's a great movie.
Hey, we're Maggie back. And Crystal are watching porn.
Not right now.
No. And not right now, they're not.
My mother listens to this podcast.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
She's like a badass.
Now they're Googling people from their porn.
No, it is
they're Googling porn stars. We are definitely on some kind of list.
Yeah, 100%.
She played.
Is this? I think our podcast has been taken.
I think it has.
Girl Interrupted. That's what I was thinking.
Yes.
Oh my God.
I don't think
what
she's
is happening?
Life,
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the movie y'all are talking about?
I don't know. All I saw was Maggie Goat.
But I'm a cheerleader. How old is this?
It's literally
1999.
Yeah.
And this is a gay movie.
Yeah.
Look how cute Natasha Lyonne is in it. She's like a baby in it.
I know.
She's
what?
In...
Is this movies with Mag and Slam?
Slam, yeah. We've been taken
she's
over.
She plays Selena's like main character's body double. She's
hey.
Fucking hilarious. And then she ends up dating her daughter. So maybe she is gay.
Wow. So, does anyone want to talk about Morda?
Yes.
Ghosties.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Because that's what this is.
This is
a murder podcast.
This is not
a Natasha Lyonne podcast.
Unfortunately. I haven't listened to that.
Oh my God.
God, I love her voice.
Well,
if she had a podcast,
yeah,
her voice is fantastic.
I bet she does have a podcast.
Probably.
Everyone has a podcast.
You guys don't.
Not yet.
They might after this.
Things. Oh, she has a podcast.
Mm.
Okay, well, this is about our podcast. So.
Okay, so it's not about you guys right now. It's about us.
Yes.
So, thanks.
Okay.
So, back to Kurt Cobain.
Yes. This
All
is
right.
your second part.
This is part two.
Buckle up.
So, now we're up to March 3rd, 1994. Setting is in Rome. Kurt calls a hotel staff member to go pick him up a prescription for Rufinol.
Oh, super cash.
Better known as Roofies, if you didn't know. AKA date rape drug. Oh my God.
Continue.
Okay.
She's on our team.
But, like, this is my lack of drug knowledge here again. But, like, what's the point of Roofies? Like, I understand what they're used for and that you put them in someone's
drink. But what's
the
real reason?
But, like, why? What's their original purpose?
Yes.
Why were
it's
they
not the date rape drug.
What does it treat? Is it just like a sleeping pill?
It causes paralysis.
Slam, Google that.
What?
Look that up.
Look that up, Slam.
What was Rufinol, like, prescribed for?
Probably as an anesthetic at first, and it causes paralysis.
Interesting.
So, like, you're awake, but, like, you can't do anything. Sometimes, medically, you just find things that do things, and then you're like, huh.
Okay, that's
necessarily.
Thank you, Dr.
Good,
Maggie.
I'm just
yeah,
saying, like,
love that.
You eventually find things and you're like, oh, that does that.
That's great. But, like, why would you take it recreationally? Does it make you high?
At first, hospitals used the drug in 1975.
Right.
When a patient needed a deep sleep.
Okay.
It was a sleeping pill then.
Okay, yeah. So, like, a sedative. But, like, why would you take it recreationally? That doesn't
you
seem...
You wouldn't. You would give it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, why... Like, you could get high on anything. You're Kurt Cobain. Why are you sending someone off to Rufinol?
Rufinol, yeah.
That's really weird. So, he OD'd on Rufinol. I didn't even know that, like, was a thing. Then Courtney found him with blood coming out of his mouth, so she called an ambulance.
Oh, that's bad.
She said this was his first suicide attempt because... And this is her reasoning. This is her reasoning for Kurt Cobain's first... suicide
attempt. I'm sure it adds up. I'm sure it makes so much sense.
It's so tracks. This is like such a Courtney Love thing to say. She said that she had been thinking, she had not told him this, she had been thinking about cheating on him. And just the mere thought of her thinking that she's going to cheat on him drove him over the edge to commit suicide. But she hadn't told him.
She didn't tell him.
She was just thinking it.
And he read her mind?
Is that not, like, the biggest junkie thing to say?
Like, that's...
It makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
So, and also, like, after this attempt, I say with quotation marks, she doesn't tell anybody. Like, if he's suicidal, wouldn't you, like, go to the band and, like, go to Dave Grohl and be like, hey, Dave, you know, we should
something's...
probably... Something's fucky with Kurt.
Yeah.
I think maybe we should keep an eye on him.
Yeah.
This is
not just not tell anybody.
Right. This happened in Rome. So she said he had 67 pills that they pumped out of his stomach.
Holy fuck.
Okay, but like how? Like how did this bellboy in the middle of the night go get 67 Rufinols when it said it was a prescription? He was filling a prescription. What pharmacy's open in the middle of the night? How are you getting prescribed that much Rufinol?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. So the doctor that attended to him said that he pumped nowhere near that amount out of Kurt, and that he pumped a lot out, but it wasn't enough to kill him. It was just enough for like Kurt to be fucking around with something.
Yeah. Like he was just extra fucked up.
Right. So, but here's also, you know, the other side of things. If Courtney wanted him dead, why did she call the ambulance? Why not just like let him die there?
Yeah.
You know? But also I'm thinking
maybe
like,
to make her story, the story, not her story, when he actually does die, even more credible.
Right. I think she wanted to distance herself as much as she could from it. So, like, we see, like, when he does die, he's in Seattle, she's in L.A. There's no way they can say Courtney killed him.
Yeah.
But now she's here in the hotel room in Rome. She's not stupid. I mean, Courtney's very smart. They could associate and bring this back to her.
Yeah.
You know, the wife did it. Of course she did it. So, I can see that. So, I have so many questions about this case. So, now we're up to March 18th. Courtney calls 911 again because now they're back in Seattle, and she says Kurt has locked himself in a room full of loaded weapons and he's threatening to kill himself. So, however, the police that were on the scene told a different story. They said that when they arrived on scene, Courtney's standing on the front porch. She's hysterical. She's saying he's inside. He's locked himself in a room. He has a loaded gun. He's going to kill himself. So the police walk around back to gain access to the house. And when they do, they find Kurt just, like, standing in the backyard, like, looking up at the sky with his hands in his pockets. And like, they're like,
nothing.
What up?
Like, hey.
Aren't you supposed to be in there, like, freaking out?
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem suicidal at all. He just seems fine. And he's just, like, really embarrassed that she called the cops. And he's like, yeah, like, we had a fight and, like, we had an argument. But I just locked myself in that room, and not with a gun or anything, just because I wanted to get away from Courtney. Which I'm like, yeah, tracks.
Yeah,
like, I get it. And Courtney said, okay, I didn't actually see him with a gun, and I didn't know if any weapons were in there or not.
Oh, my gosh. So I just decided to tell you there was.
Yeah. She's like, but he did say he was going to kill himself. And he's like, nah, I didn't say
that. That didn't happen.
That didn't happen. So, but anyways, regardless of who said what, cops took all Kurt's guns out of the house. So because of this, because he had no guns, he and his friend Dylan Carlson go and buy Kurt a brand new Remington shotgun. And this is the gun that's going to kill him.
Yeah.
Yep. Dylan technically bought this gun since Kurt couldn't get the paperwork in order to do so because if the police found out he got another gun,
they would
just come and take that gun.
Yeah.
But he said he needed the gun for protection because he didn't have any bodyguards. I mean, he's this punk rock guy. He's not going to get all bougie and get bodyguards. And he's, you know, as we learned in the first part of the podcast, He has a brand new house, and it doesn't have a security system, so he's paranoid about something.
Reason to protect himself.
Like, that tells me, and maybe I'm assuming too much, but like, the dude buys a gun, he makes a will, he has a security system installed.
Like, there's a reason for
it.
It
doesn't
those
sound
things.
Like he's gonna commit suicide. No. It sounds like he's afraid of something. That's just my thought. And it is sus that, like, the day before the security system was to be installed, he's killed.
Yeah.
Like, the day before it could catch anything. So, after the purchase of the gun, Cobain travels to L.A. to check himself into rehab. Again, not something that people are going to kill themselves typically do. They don't typically want or care to get clean before they commit suicide. So, it doesn't seem like that's his plan. And now we're back to the beginning that led us to the events in part one. So one more thing before we get into the theories and the crazy shit surrounding the crime scene. Remember how I told you in part one that Kurt left his house in Lake Washington to go buy shells for his new shotgun?
Yeah.
Well, he used a taxi to do that. So according to the reports from the taxi driver, he said Kurt told him, Kurt told the taxi driver that his house was broken into a few days ago and he needed to go buy shells for his new shotgun. And where could he go buy shells at? And the taxi cab driver took him
to where to get them.
To where to get them.
Where to get them. Where to get them.
Where to get them. Now, a couple ways to look at this. Either he's telling the truth and someone actually did try to break into his house, which leads me to believe that someone was there to hurt him. Something happened and fucked it up. He got spooked, whatever. He left. Or Kurt is full of shit and he's really buying the bullets to kill himself, because why would you actually tell the cab driver, I'm going to use this gun to kill myself? But also, Kurt is the type of guy to say, I hate myself and want to die, to people who just ask how he's doing. So maybe he would say that to a cab driver. Like, he's so, like, ah. So, however, the police report doesn't say that the cab driver, it doesn't say that he picked up Kurt Cobain specifically. It says he picked up a male from the house.
So it couldn't.
It could have been
someone else.
Anyway. So April 3rd, Courtney hires private investigator Tom Grant to track down whoever stole Kurt's credit card. Okay, so on April 3rd, Courtney hires a private investigator, Tom Grant, to track down whoever stole Kurt's stolen credit card. However, Tom Grant is now a main believer in the theory that Courtney had Kurt killed. The private investigor that she hired
thinks
is now suspicious of Courtney because of what he's found out.
That backfired. I
thought that was interesting. So when Tom meets Courtney, Courtney tells him, okay, forget the credit card. Actually, you're here to find Kurt, because he's been missing for 6 days and you need to find him. He escaped from rehab in LA. He might be in Seattle. He might still be in LA. He might even be down in Atlanta recording a song with so-and-so. She didn't know, but she lied because she did know. She knew he was back in Seattle because the day before she learned from their live-in nanny, Callie, who was Courtney's ex-boyfriend. He's a manny, not a nanny.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, thought that was interesting. She actually had a conversation with him, and where he obviously probably would have told her, hey, did you know Kurt's here? And I saw him, and we talked, and, like, everything's fine. Well, they pulled phone records, because, like, Courtney's like, oh, no, he didn't tell me any of that, blah, blah, blah. But April 2nd, they pull phone records to show that Callie and Courtney talked on the phone 8 times that day. Like, why are you talking that many times? And how, like, after 8 times, like, your husband's missing for 6 days. How is your nanny not just going to be like, oh, yeah, I saw him at breakfast today. Like, he's fine. He's here. Like, how do you not mention
that? Just leave
that
part out.
Yeah. So, let's see. I lost my place. So, April 2nd, phone records show they talked 8 times. Also on April 2nd is the same day on the receipt for the shotgun shells that was found next to Kurt's body. And it's the same day that the cabbie reported he picked up a male from the house. This is like tinfoil hat time. So also on April 2nd, Courtney files a missing persons report with the police under the name of Kurt's mother, Wendy. She doesn't file it under her name. The report reads that Kurt escaped rehab. He hopped a plane to Seattle. He bought a shotgun and he was suicidal. That's what she wrote on April 2nd that he was missing under his mother's name. So she knew he was in Seattle. So why didn't she tell the private investigator
that he was in Seattle?
Yeah. So people say that she filed this under his mother's name because Courtney Love was just so self-aware of herself and her perception and reputation with society that she knew police wouldn't take her seriously if she filed it under her own name. Therefore, she filed it under his mom's name so that the police would take her claim seriously. I don't think Courtney Love is so self-aware that she's like, you know, I'm kind of a bitch and people don't like me.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to take me seriously. Like, I don't think she's going to think that about herself. So other people say she did this to cover her own ass and set up a timeline for events that were unfold later. So when they found Kurt, she would look like the blameless, grieving, worried wife who tried like hell to find him before he hurt himself. It makes her look good. Mm-hmm. So April 6th, Tom Grant finally convinces Courtney to let him travel to Seattle to search for Kurt at their house. Like, why didn't you look at the house first?
Kurt, to begin with,
I don't understand. Like, you escape rehab. Where's the first place you're going to go? First, you're probably going to go get high. But then you're probably going to go home. Like, I want to be high at my house. Like, that's where I want to be high. So I don't understand why you wouldn't do that first. But she finally lets him search the house. So he goes. He does so. And Dylan Carlson, who bought him the gun, leads Tom around the house. But they don't find anything. However, they neglect to check the greenhouse apartment. But in their defense, it was, like, really dark and rainy, and they say that, like, you can't really see the apartment on top of the garage. They didn't even know it was there. So the next day, they go back to search again, and they want to check the nook in his closet, like, where he kept his shotgun, to see if his shotgun's there. But when they go to go up the steps to his bedroom, they find a note on the steps from Callie, the nanny, that basically says, like, Kurt, I had no idea you've been in the house the whole time. I had no idea you were here. You are an asshole for not calling Courtney and letting her know. Oh, like
that. Yeah, bullshit. No one knew he was there.
So now the note was not there the day before when they were there and they searched the entire house. I think they would have seen it.
Yeah.
And after the fact, they realized that Kurt at this time had been dead for a couple of days. So how are you there the whole time? And, like, they're trying to establish a timeline.
Yes.
It's, like, what's happening here.
For sure.
It definitely seems like a cover-up. So, timeline. Kurt dies on the 5th. Dylan and Tom search the house on the 6th. They find the note on the 7th. That doesn't make any sense at all. So, but listen, another Uno reverse. It could be possible that Callie thought Dylan and Tom moving through the house the day before was Kurt. But Tom Grant claims that this was Courtney's way of trying to fuck with the timeline, making it seem like Kurt was alive longer than he actually was. So now we're up to the discovery of Kurt's body on April 8th. After Kurt is reported dead, and because thanks to Gary Smith who found the body, after he called the police, he also called the local rock station to tell them that Kurt Cobain is dead. Which is really insensitive and shitty.
That is not right at all.
Tom Grant finds out that Kurt's dead, and he then receives word that Kurt's credit card, remember, his stolen credit card, was attempted to be used the day before to buy $40 worth of flowers.
What?
To this day, that little tidbit of information that his card was used to buy flowers or tried to remains a mystery. We have no idea who had his card or who was trying to buy flowers or why.
That's a random ass thing to buy.
I'm like, that is bananas. So, let's talk more about the scene. It's reported that it had to be a suicide because the door was locked from the inside and there was a stool wedged up against the door to prevent it from opening. But this isn't necessarily true. The door was locked, but it was a turn lock, so you can have it open, turn the lock, and shut it, and it would lock. And the stool was actually across the apartment, across another door that led out to the apartment's balcony. So, there's two ways to get in here.
Oh, okay.
Now, here's the head scratcher. There was no legible fingerprints found on the gun or the box of shells or the trigger or anything. Like, he handled the gun. If he commits suicide, his fingerprints at least should be on the gun. But there's no fingerprints, no legible fingerprints. This leads me to believe that the gun and the shells were wiped down. But on the last podcast on the left, they state that the humidity in the greenhouse could have had something to do with, like, the fingerprints being erased or, like, not being there.
Yeah.
Something fucky happened with them. But also, it's really shitty police work because they didn't test the gun for prints until a few months later. And they didn't test the shells for a couple years. Oh. Why wouldn't that?
That'd be the first suicide by gun. Yeah.
Why are you not testing for fingerprints? So that's shitty police work. their reasoning, it was because it was obvious it was a suicide as soon as they walked in.
You can't decide for
That's not protocol. You treat every case like it's a homicide, yeah. Especially in such a high-profile case with a high-profile dead person.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the shell trajectory, because, I mean, he's sitting down. He's balancing the shotgun between his feet. Shotguns are what, like 50 inches long? Some shit? So he reaches down, you know, he has it between his feet. I'm trying to, like, do it.
Yeah, it's not.
And he reaches down. Like, my arms don't fucking reach my feet. Like, I know I'm not as little as Kurt Cobain, but, like,
no.
That's uncomfortable AF to, like, try to shoot yourself like that. Oh, Maggie has a question or a comment.
I need to pull the trigger with his toe.
That's what I was going to say.
They didn't say that. They said he pulled the trigger with his thumb.
Was he barefoot?
I don't think he was.
I
think he had shoes on because they just released some pictures that he had shoes on. So this is a weird angle to shoot yourself. And the gun was found on top of his body, but like upside down. Like the barrel was pointing that way. It was upside down on his body.
It's going to go off and things are going to happen. It could fall that way.
They say that the recoil of the gun could have caused it to land upside down, but the shell, from the trajectory it was, should have landed on his left side. Wait, hold on. It ended up on his left side. It should have been on his right side, the way the gun was pointed.
Is it a shotgun?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that leads people to believe that someone else pulled the trigger and then placed the gun on his body. But people also say the recoil caused the gun to land upside down, which is possible because the gun is low gauge, so it doesn't have a high-powered recoil, because if it had a high-powered recoil, it would have shot across the room, because shotguns have a pretty good kick. The gun could have also been bumped by first responders who just kind of, like, picked it up and was like, oh, fuck, and just kind of, like, put it back where they thought they found it, which surprisingly happens more often than we're told. Like, that's kind of frightening.
I mean, they're trying to save somebody, or, like, they're on the scene first, so it's, like, hard to...
I get it. So now the suicide note. I'm just going to read it to you. It's a page long, and you can tell me what it sounds like to you. It says, to Buddha, because again, his imaginary friend, which is weird. Speaking from the tongue of an experienced simpleton who obviously would rather be emasculated, infantile, complainy, this note should be pretty easy to understand. All of the warnings from the punk rock 101 courses over the years and since my first introduction to the, shall we say, ethics involved with independence and the embracement of your community has proven to be very true. I haven't felt the excitement of listening to as well as creating music along with reading and writing for far too many years now. I feel guilty beyond words about these things. For example, when we're backstage and the lights go out and the manic roar of the crowd begins, it doesn't affect me in the way which it did for Freddie Mercury, who seemed to love and relish in the love and adoration from the crowd, which is something I totally admire and envy. The fact is, I can't fool you, any of you. It simply isn't fair to you or me. The worst crime I can think of would be to rip people off by faking it or pretend as if I'm having 100% fun. Sometimes I feel as if I should have punched in a time clock before I walk out on stage. I've tried everything within my power to appreciate, and I do, God believe me I do, but it's not enough. I appreciate the fact that I and we have affected and entertained a lot of people. It must be one of those narcissists who only appreciate things when they're gone. I'm too sensitive. I need to slightly numb in order to begin to regain the enthusiasm I once had as a child. On our last three tours, I've had much better appreciation for all the people I've known personally and as fans of our music, but I still can't get over the frustration, the guilt, and empathy I have for everyone. There's good in all of us, and I think I simply love people too much. So that makes it makes me feel too fucking sad. The sad little sensitive, unappreciative Pisces Jesus man. Why don't you just enjoy it? I don't know. I have a goddess of a wife who sweats ambition and empathy and a daughter who reminds me too much of what I used to be. full of love and joy, kissing every person she meets because everyone is good and will never do her harm. And that terrifies me to the point to where I can barely function. I can't stand the thought of Frances becoming the miserable, self-destructive death rocker that I've become. I have it good, very good, and I'm grateful. But since the age of 7, I've become hateful towards all humans in general, only because it seems so easy for people to get along that have empathy. Only because I love and feel sorry for people too much, I guess. Thank you all from the pit of my burning, nauseous stomach for your letters and concern during the past years. I'm too much of an erratic, moody baby. I don't have the passion anymore. And so remember, it's better to burn out than to fade away. Peace, love, and empathy. Kurt Cobain. Frances and Courtney, I'll be at your altar. Please keep going, Courtney, for Frances. For her life, which will be so much happier without me. I love you. I love you.
That's so sad.
It is so sad. But does it sound suicidal?
No.
Apart from the last four lines.
Yeah, the end part.
To me, it sounds like he's leaving the band. It sounds like he's giving up the music industry altogether.
Yeah.
And there's evidence to back that up. Nirvana recently, at this time, had pulled out of the music festival Lollapalooza. And in a 1988 interview, Dave Grohl even confirmed that Nirvana was in the process of breaking up during this time. So the last four lines, people in the camp that he was murdered say that those were added on later. That Kurt had indeed written the rest of the note, because it's all in his handwriting, because he was leaving Nirvana. But whoever killed him added the last four lines to make it seem more like a suicide note. And I'm going to post a pic of what the actual note looked like. But the last four lines look so much different than the rest of the note. They're, like, written in almost, like, a different font. It's a lot bigger than the rest of the note. It's really strange. They also found in Courtney's possession paper where she's attempting to copy Kurt's signature. Which, that's a little suspicious.
That is suspicious.
But also, like, flip it and reverse it. Kurt was a super junkie. Courtney was basically running the whole enterprise at this point. Kurt had, like, checked out of life. There's probably a valid reason that she needed to be practicing his signature for, like, business documents and whatnot.
Yeah.
Not that that's, like, okay to forge his signature, but I'm just saying it could be a reason of why she was practicing it. Now let's talk about the heroine of it all. This is the part that I can't get past. Tom Grant and medical professionals agree that the amount of heroin in his system would have made it impossible for him to pull the trigger. Even for as much of an addict as Kurt was, that's still a shit ton of heroin.
Yeah.
Because remember, after he was done shooting up, he put away his stash, he rolled down his sleeve, and then proceeded to get in that weird-ass position to shoot himself. Medical professionals say, no, he would not have been coherent enough
to do that
and then complete the process of suicide. Like, as soon as he shot up, he would have been lucky to get the needle out of his arm before he either died or just, like, lost consciousness altogether. So the problem with the heroin evidence is that there just isn't enough data out there or studies done on heroin to know for sure. Like, we can't just go shooting up people with heroin to see how they react. Or how much it takes to kill someone.
Yeah.
So we just don't know. And it all depends on, like, the purity of the heroin and his tolerance. And, like, we don't have too much data on, like, tolerance levels and how much he could have actually taken.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So here's something else shady. The medical examiner was actually friends with Courtney Love. This is the medical examiner that ruled it a suicide. He was actually friends with Courtney Love back in the LA music scene in the
80s. I didn't
know
that either.
So, like, that's a little suspicious.
Yeah, I feel like he should not have been able to work on that case.
So all of this conspiracy murder stuff is to say that the prevailing murder theory is that Callie the nanny is the one to shoot Kurt up with too much heroin to render him incapacitated, kill him, and then cover it all up under, you know, the direction of Courtney Love.
Yeah,
and it's a suicide. But he did it all under
her. She told him to. Yeah.
So that's, like, the main theory. There's another theory that the CIA killed him because he endorsed Bill Clinton, and he was gonna, like, rise up all these youths to the end, like, anarchism and over for their government. So that's another theory that's out there. Then the third theory is one about oh my god, I called him El Jefe, but what's his real name?
El Duce.
Yeah. which was a singer of another band called the Melvins, that he was hired by Courtney Love to kill him. And El Duce, I mean, doesn't sound like a stand-up guy. Like, he's kind of a deadbeat. Like, all these people involved in this story are, like, shithead junkies. Like, there's not, like, a good person to deal with here. Yeah. Like, so El Duce, I guess, worked at, like, a record store before he, like, became a singer. And Courtney walks in and says she'll pay him $50,000 to kill her old man because she's driving crazy. Kurt Cobain. Shoot him in the head. And this is confirmed by the person that he was working with. And this was a couple years before Kurt was actually killed or died.
Oh.
So she said she'll give him a call when she wants him to do it.
You just mentioned it ahead of time?
Yeah, just like way in ahead
of
time.
Make sure you got it lined up.
Yeah. So then the story goes that she called him, like, you know, in March of this year, April of 94, when Kurt died, and asked his person that he worked with, the other witness to it, if he was there. And he said, no, he's out on tour with the Melvins. He's not here. So apparently he missed his chance at doing it. And what's crazy is that when he was interviewed by, like, FBI, like, in the later 90s, he passed a polygraph test about all of this. Which you always hear about people failing polygraph tests.
Not really. They don't.
But you don't really ever hear about them passing them. Now, it could have been he was on, like, so much heroin that it just, like, narrowed his senses. And he's just like, yeah, like, everything's cool.
He didn't ever think about
Like, yeah, he didn't think about it. He just was talking. It's crazy. Like, the El Duce theory goes way, way into it. But bottom line is that he missed his chance. And that's when she went to Callie the nanny. And
had him
do it. I don't know. I think it can be a combination of the two, is that she went to him first, El Duce, and then went to Callie when El Duce couldn't do it. So that's my opinion on it. But she still owns all of Nirvana's music and, you know, rights to the music. So, like, you can't, like, play Nirvana music on a public forum without, like, getting Courtney Love's permission or, like, paying her mad royalties for it. Which I think is so shitty, because, like, Dave Grohl's still alive. Yeah. Like, why is he not making money off it? Yeah.
She didn't.
And, like, there's this whole, like, feud between Courtney and Dave Grohl, like, throughout the 90s. And, like, they sued the shit out of each other for years. And it's just, it's nuts. She's a fucking crazy person.
Yeah. It goes, like, real deep.
So that is Kurt Cobain. Did he commit suicide? Or was he murdered?
Yeah. A wild ride.
It was crazy. It keeps me up at night, and I just, like, keep going deeper. I'm like, but then this could happen, but on the other side this could happen, and I'm like, oh my gosh. So I think even after all my research, I'm still in the camp that he was killed. That's how I came into this, and I thought maybe it would change my mind, but it didn't. It's the heroin of it all. Like, he had so much heroin in his system that he put away his shit. Like, why would you put away your shit? You wouldn't do that if you're going
to
kill yourself.
It's a lot to do with that lethal dose.
And you roll down your sleeve? Like, you wouldn't do that. It's bananas.
It's a lot.
So, are you going to scare me with something? Or no, you have a true crime.
Yeah.
Double true crime.
Yes. I guess I should get my notes.
Oh, I guess you should.
I wasn't ready. I'm, like, waiting.
I was waiting for you, like,
5 seconds.
Maybe I was waiting for the clacker.
Yeah, right.
Hey, that worked.
Okay.
The light turned back on.
Is it a clap light? Was that what we've been doing wrong?
Oh, my God. Is it a clap light?
Okay. So, now it's my turn.
Fuck me up with some true crime.
Okay. So, I am going to do the tragic murder of Emma Walker. So, Emma Jane Walker was born on March 20th, 2000 in Knoxville, Tennessee, to parents Jill and Mark Walker. She had one sibling, younger brother, Evan. She grew up wanting to be a neonatal nurse.
Aww.
And she had a really big soft spot for animals.
Oh, I love her.
She was described as being beautiful and vibrant. And I am telling you, this girl was gorgeous. Mm. She was so pretty. By her freshman year of high school, there wasn't much, like, about her upbringing in anything I read. And a lot of my information came from an ABC News article I read. And part from a podcast I watched. By her freshman year of high school, she was a popular bubbly member of the Bobcat cheerleading squad, which she was very passionate about and took very seriously. By that fall, she had caught the eye of older football player Riley Gall, who was a junior.
Gall, who had been raised by his grandparents and mother, was said to be a top student who loved to play video games. Emma's mom called him the boy next door. He was polite, nice, and likable. Her father, Mark Walker, thought he was well-mannered, and the pair allowed them to have supervised visits at their house. Riley would come over. Sometimes they would meet up after football games. And on all accounts of by their friends, said that she seemed happy with Riley in the beginning. Her social media accounts, you know, typical teenager, is flooded with pictures and quotes and, like, headlines that say, look how lucky I am, with pictures of the two. Friends soon began noticing, though, odd things about Riley. He wouldn't really talk to her friends very much, and at first they just thought he was shy, but quickly they grew concerned because it seemed to them that they didn't want Riley, or Riley didn't want Emma to hang out with anybody but him. So he's already being, like, a little controlling. That was actually the next. He became controlling over her and what she did. He also wouldn't let her wear certain things. Over the course of the next 2 years, they became the classic high school couple, constantly breaking up and getting back together. They had really dramatic arguments over texts and Snapchat messages. Her mother, Jill, said he would always comment on what she wore, telling her what she should and shouldn't wear, until her mother finally said something about it to Emma, who kind of just brushed it off like it was, like, really no big deal. According to friend Lauren Hutton, things got crazy. Riley would wait for her outside the grocery store where she worked for hours at a time, like he would just stand outside. Friends told Emma that they didn't like the way he treated her, but she kind of just went along and did her own thing. Kind of like the more you tell your friend not to, they're just going to do it more. Fights between the pair were intense, with some messages from Riley on Snapchat stating, I hate you. I hate everything about you. And another message said, you're the biggest bitch I've ever come in contact with. One particular message somehow her parents saw, that it said, you're dead to me. I'll check the obituary, .. you.
Ew.
Yeah. When confronted about these messages by her parents, he said he was just angry, but that was just one of the many red flags that the parents began to notice. It got so bad that they eventually banned him from their home and took away Emma's phone, in an attempt to keep the pair from communicating. It didn't work. Riley had given Emma an iPod Touch, which she was able to use with Wi-Fi to text him. After every nasty message Riley would send to Emma, he would there, like, immediately after apologize, saying he was just angry, saying things like, Emma, I'm sorry for however I act, and I love you more than words can describe. Emma's parents advised the teen several times to end things with Riley, who had a way of isolating her and making her feel like she was the only one. Jill said, the more you butt heads with the teenager, the more she is going to think she is right. By the fall of 2016, Riley and Emma were still dating, though Riley, who was now 18, had graduated and was a freshman at a nearby college. Around Halloween, her parents decided to ground her, not allowing her to leave the house except to go to work and cheerleading practice, and, like, if they had football games and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
After some time of monitoring, everywhere that she went, it seemed to work. Her father was quoted saying, she did become more like herself again. She would come out of her room, eat dinner with us, and socialize with us. Emma even got to a point where she texted her friend Keegan Lyle and told her she and Riley were done for good. Gall did not seem to take that very well. It's alleged that he swallowed a bunch of Vicodin pills and washed them down with alcohol in an attempt to commit suicide. Close friends of Riley also started to notice his mood swings and that he was depressed and wanted to hurt himself. On Friday, November 18th, 2016, Emma was allowed to go to a party at her friend's house. At around 11:30, one of her other friends named Zach arrived at the party, and Emma, like, kind of pulled him aside and said she was getting strange text messages from a number that wasn't saved in her phone. Like, she didn't know who it was. Some of them read things like, come outside alone if you don't want your loved one to get hurt.
Ew.
Go to your car with your keys. Go alone. I've got someone you love. If you don't comply, I will hurt them. Emma thought at first it was just one of Riley's friends playing, like, a prank on her. She texts back and threatened to call the police. The text message became, like, more menacing after that. Things like, if you'd like to hear him crying and screaming, give him a call. Emma was begging her friend for help because she didn't know what to do at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually she tells Zach that she had got a text saying that they had dropped Riley outside, like, of the party she was at. So Zach and Emma go outside, and sure enough, once they get outside, like, illuminated in the streetlight outside, they found a body lying face down in the ditch near the house. They finally reach him, and it is Riley. He has a really confused look on his face,
They proceeded to ask him what he was doing there. Riley said he did not know what was happening, where he was, and that he'd been kidnapped and someone had dropped him off there. Like, he had no idea how he got there. He was holding his head like he had been hit with something. Emma immediately became uneasy, and they both thought it was super weird. Like, really weird circumstances. Emma kind of just told him, we broke up, like, leave me alone. So Riley walked off and called one of his friends, named Noah Walton, and told him that he had been kidnapped, but his friend didn't believe a single word he said. So already, like, your friends already think that what you're saying is bullshit. His friend said that he sounded like he had been crying or he was fatigued. He had told Noah that basically these people had knocked him out, took his car, and threw him in a van. Riley also reportedly said not to call the cops to report the incident. His friend was like, he said, nope, no cops, no cops at all. So, and none of Emma's friends contacted police about the incident either. So no one really knew about it besides them. The following morning, so it would have been Saturday, Emma went home and texted her friends that there was a stranger at her doorstep. And this was like the, I think, the direct text. It said, I'm home alone and somebody in all black walked down my street. And on the the 2020 episode I watched, they have like security footage of this person like dressed in black walking down her road. Ew. Like just some random person. But yeah, I'm home alone and somebody in all black walked down my street and came to my door and rang the doorbell over and over again. She texts, I thought I was going to die. Then she texts Riley, I hate you, but I need you right now. He responded, I'm coming. I'm speeding. Just give me a minute. Emma had previously made plans with her mother to meet her that morning. And when she failed to meet up with her mother, Jill, she went home to see, you know, what was going on. When she arrived, she found Emma and Riley in the front yard. She immediately gets out of the vehicle, like, because he's not allowed there. They've banned him from the house. He knows he's not allowed to be there. And politely, starts off polite, asking him to leave. To which he responded, no, I'm here to help. I'm making sure Emma is okay. And he kept trying to speak to Jill and, like, talk her out of, like, making him leave. And she finally just told him, you know you're not allowed here. You need to go. So he did. Jill could see that Emma was visibly shaken. She thought the man in black could have been a burglar or maybe even a stalker. Jill didn't buy it, though. She told Emma, don't you find it odd that Riley was involved or appeared at both events? Emma did not believe it was Riley, though. She was like, there's no way it's him, Mom. Jill felt Riley was going way overboard trying to get Emma's attention, and the family was worried about her, so they kept a close eye on her. That Sunday, her parents followed her to work and followed her back home afterward to make sure she made it safely. By Sunday evening, everything seemed normal. She was texting with her friend about a homework assignment and went to bed around midnight. Her dad went in to, like, tell her, hey, I'm going to bed. Good night. I love you. And gave her a kiss, and he went to bed, too. And sometime in the middle of the night, it doesn't specify a time, but her father, Mark, was awakened by, like, a really loud noise, and it sounded like it was inside the house. He said it sounded like someone was in the house, and they had to slam a door. Mm-hmm. And then he heard it again, so it was, like, a loud door slam twice. He got out of bed to check on Emma and her brother. He went into Emma's room first, and he said she was sound asleep. He was like, I stood there for, like, 5 to 10 seconds and just watched her sleep and then shut the door. I went and checked on Evan. They were both in bed, asleep. He checked the surrounding of the house and the doors and all that, and he went back to bed because there was, like, nothing going on. The next morning, a little after 6 a.m. on Monday, November 21st, her mother went in to wake her up for school, but she was unable to wake her. She said her name first, but she didn't get a response. So she went over, like, kind of bumped her leg, like, hey, come on, get up. And she still didn't get anything. And then that was when she looked at her face and she realized something was, like, really wrong. She checked for a pulse and couldn't find one. And that was when she called 911. And the one interview I watched of her talking, like, she breaks down, obviously, but she was like, I don't really remember what happened. I just remember that I eventually called 911. She told the dispatcher that she had just tried to wake her daughter up for school and that she was non-responsive. Knox County Sheriff's Department, Nikki Buells, was a lead forensic tech on the case, said it was originally called in as a possible suicide. Upon arrival, they started photographing outside the house first and then proceeded to move inside. Once inside the bedroom, there appeared to be what looked like a bullet hole in the wall, which was like her bed was against the wall, and you could see it in her pillows. It was like right by where her pillows were. It was about shoulder height, small, about the size of a ballpoint pen. Once they realize that there's a bullet hole in the wall, they go, you know, outside to check the perimeter, and they find 2 shell casings. So they knew at least, like, the 2 shots had been fired. While walking the perimeter of the house, he found a second bullet hole on a different side of the house, about the same height as the first hole. Emma Walker had been killed by a single gunshot wound to her head, hitting her right behind her ear. The second bullet had lodged into her pillow. So she essentially was shot from outside of her house through the wall.
Oh my god.
Yeah. I lost my spot. When police started interviewing her friends, one name kept coming up, Riley Gall. Friends had seen the way the relationship was between the two and the way Riley had spoken to her. Riley posted on social media to mourn Emma. Rest easy now, sweetheart. I love you forever and always. A candlelight vigil was held the night after her death. Her devastated friends and family were the ones who put it together. I don't know why that was so hard to say. At Central High, the following, like, next football game they had after she passed away, her fellow cheerleaders released balloons in her memory. Man, I fucked up. Sorry. Riley's friends began to grow concerned about his well-being following Emma's death. They had told detectives a secret Riley had shared with friend Alex McCarty the day after he was supposedly kidnapped. He said that he was fearful for his life and that he had stolen his grandfather's gun, and he had even shown it to them. He reassured his friends he was the furthest thing from suicidal and that he was just so scared of these people out to get him, out to get Emma. Another of Riley's friends told detectives that he had asked him how to get fingerprints off of a gun, but when Riley asked him, he was like, I'm just asking for my roommate. Kind of like, I'm asking for a friend.
That's... no.
And he admitted to his friend, like, I know it's weird, I'm sorry, I won't ask you anything like that again, but it was just for my friend.
Yeah, that's weird, dude.
Yeah. So on Monday, detectives brought Riley in for questioning regarding his whereabouts during the previous 72 hours. He said he thought he had spent the night at his friend Noah Walton's house. During the two-hour interrogation, he never once referred to Emma by her name. Ever.
I've heard this, and yeah, that interview is really creepy.
He simply called her the girl.
The girl. Yeah. Oh, I hate that.
The girl, this was a quote, the girl, she texted me, is what he told detectives. And detectives were like, which girl? Like, which one are you talking about? And he said the one who passed away. Like, he would not call her by her name.
My God.
When Detective James Hurst first met him, he originally thought that he was just a grieving boyfriend. But once they got him into the interview room and sat him down, he said he felt that there was a very, like, big dark side to him and that he didn't seem to have a lot of passion or concern. He told detectives he had been trying to speak to Emma all weekend, but she wouldn't talk to him. But she said if I would help her with her paper, she would talk to me, he told detectives. He said he used one of his friend's phones on campus to call her and that their phone call didn't go very well. She supposedly said a bunch of mean things and then proceeded to block, like, said friend's phone number. After the phone call, he said he drove over to his parents' house briefly, then returned to campus. Once back at college, he broke down and cried for 2 to 3 hours in his car over the breakup with Emma. Detectives described him as emotionalist in the interview room while recounting his previous, like, events from the 72 hours before that. The detective actually was quoted saying his interview was probably one of the most disconnected. It almost seemed rehearsed, Detective Merritt told 2020. With the previous information from friend McCarty, they already knew about his grandfather's gun that Riley had shown them. And his grandfather actually kept the 9mm weapon in his vehicle and had reported it missing because he noticed that it was gone. Mm-hmm. Riley was asked about the gun, he told detectives he didn't know where it was. He denied ever showing his friends and denied asking about removing fingerprints. The detectives proceeded to ask for Riley's cell phone, and he asked them if he was a suspect, to which they responded, should you be? Riley continued to deny any involvement in the death of Emma. Once he left the police station, McCarty said that he started receiving texts from Riley asking him why he told police about the gun. He asked his friends not to talk to the police anymore. No one obviously believed Riley. Like, from the cops, his friends, none of it. So, Alex and Noah, his buddies, and this was actually their idea. They told the cops, like, we want to help you, like, recover the weapon. Like, they were the ones who said, hey, let's do this.
Yeah, this part's badass.
Yeah, it is. And I watched, like, the footage of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, they collaborated with police to help lay a trap to catch Riley. So, that Tuesday following Emma's murder, the two teens were wired with microphones, a transmitter where police could listen, and a video camera that was hidden in a key fob. And you see on the video, they invite him over to play video games, and, like, Riley sits down on the couch, and there's a table in the middle, and he takes the key fob, like, he even reenacts it on the video, and sets the key fob facing directly at Riley while they're just sitting there talking. And he immediately starts bringing up shit with the gun, and, like, how, over-explaining why he had it.
Yeah.
And you could tell at first, like, he didn't know if he could trust his friends, but then the further they went, the more he started talking.
Mm-hmm.
But the teens understood the danger, but again, like I said, it was their idea and they wanted to help.
I know. That's, like, so brave, though. I don't know that
And you see him, like, he says that once on camera, he tells them to tell the cops they were on LSD. They were drunk. They were high. Anything, like, they were inebriated, and that their previous statements were inaccurate as to what happened with the gun and the fingerprints and all that shit, that they didn't even know what they were talking about. He asked them to go with him to the Bluff, which was, like, a place kids went to hang out and, like, smoke weed and drink and shit, but it was right by the Tennessee River. So he was going to throw the gun in the water, that they would never find it, like, police would never find the gun in the river. Which, if you didn't do anything, like, what are you trying to mm-hmm. get rid of it for? Like, it's stolen, but you're going to get in way less trouble if you just say, hey, here's this gun that's stolen, then, you know right. what I mean? He asked them to go, like, right now. He even said in the video, like, what are you guys doing right now? Like, let's do it right now. So they had to drive from their buddy's house to his stepfather's house because he had hidden it in the basement. All along, you can tell that they're, like, trying to be cool, but also trying to stall because police can hear everything. And they're apparently, they have a group text with the cops that they're, like, actively texting with the police officers from the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess once one of them said a code word was when the cops knew that, like, they could go. So you see him, like, singing along to the radio. Like, they stop and get food. And, like, the amount of chill that they are knowing what they're doing is fucking insane.
That's bananas.
Like, just as calm as I am talking to you. Like, yeah. Nothing's even going on. And, like, you're sitting next to homeboy texting the cops. Like, it was just wild.
That is.
So they go to the stepfather's house and in the basement. He has it in, like, a bag. And in the video that you see him say, like, it looked like there was clothing in the bag, too. So the cops, three cops in unmarked vehicles were tailing them the whole time. They were talking to the cops via group chat. Once the code word was said, they knew it was time to go. But they pull into an apartment building. Riley puts on white gloves, and then they saw the black clothing in the bag. And they said they were there for, like, a good 5 minutes, and they're like, what are the cops doing? Like, why are they taking so long? But they finally show up, and they call them all out of the vehicle with, like, put your hands in the air. And they retrieve the gun and the other evidence, which was the black clothing in the bag, which suggests that maybe Riley was the man in black ringing the doorbell.
Mm.
At his trial in May of 2018, Riley's defense attorney argued that he had never intended to kill Emma, that he was just trying to scare her and get her attention. He was attempting to get her to ask him for help again, like, to be her protector, like she had on that Saturday morning when she came home. He also denies being the man in black. So it only took the jurors 5 hours to deliberate and come back with a guilty verdict. Riley was found guilty of first-degree murder, as well as stalking, theft, reckless endangerment, and being in possession of a stolen firearm. In the state of Tennessee, a first-degree murder conviction automatically carries a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
At sentencing hearing, Riley, who did not speak during his entire trial, decided now was the time to talk. He apologized to Emma's family for killing their daughter, but stuck to the fact that it was an accident. He didn't mean to.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm sorry I took Emma away from you, that I robbed you of the experience of watching your daughter grow up. What I can do is tell the truth about that night. I wanted to scare her. I never meant to take Emma's life. Again, I am sorry. Jill Walker hopes her daughter's tragic death can serve as a warning to other teens in tumultuous relationships. Like, once you see the controlling side of people, like, maybe you should, like, reevaluate your situation. Since her death, her parents have tried to keep her legacy alive. They got a dog park and a NICU patient room at East Tennessee Children's Hospital named after their daughter.
Aww.
It's all, and this is a quote from her mother, it's all things that are part of Emma and mean something. She hopes people remember her by being kind to others. And then on June 4th, 2021, there was a motion put forth for a new trial, and then there was also, they were trying to get him acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
Based on insufficient evidence. Both things were denied. So
good.
He's in jail.
For the rest of his life?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I forget where I was listening to that not too long ago, but that's a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, not a good one, no, but obviously it's interesting because that's messed up.
That is.
It almost reminds me of, like,
like, Through the Wall. Like, that blew my mind. And I'm not saying that I don't believe But that fact is one thing that makes me question, like, was it an accident? Because that's, like, some aim. Like, you have to know exactly where her bed is, where she sleeps, to shoot through the wall straight into her, I'm sorry, but her head when she's asleep. Like, how do you know that? Unless there's a window that you're, like, looking through.
Right.
But, I don't know, I feel like that was too accurate.
Hi.
But, I mean, jurors found him guilty in less than 5 hours, so.
Not yet.
Slam's awake.
Sorry. So she's not...
That was, like, all of my face.
She's not folding laundry. She's just sleeping
she's
outside.
She's just sleeping now. Outside.
Yeah. We thought you fell asleep inside.
Thought about it.
All right. Well, that was my story. Thank you. That was a good one.
You're welcome.
Also, I was going to say, it kind of reminds me of, like, it's a Gypsy Blanchard case where... Like, her mom, like, kept making her sick, or, like, pretending, like, she was sick. Yeah. Say that again.
Munchausen.
Yeah, that. It's almost like that, because he, like, kept setting up situations in which she was in danger so that he could save her from it.
And that's exactly what he wanted to do. And that's what his defense attorney and himself, they were adamant about the fact that that's all he wanted to do, was to scare her, thinking, you know... Maybe these people that, you know, had kidnapped him and were ringing her doorbell were now, like, shooting at her house. Mm-hmm. And she called Riley to come swoop in and save the day.
Yeah.
But he killed her. So, I don't know. I'm torn. Because once I read and saw pictures, like, that's just scary accuracy.
Yeah.
To...
I think I almost said the shot through
the 9mm.
Like, right against the house? That's nuts.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
But the first time I heard it, I thought he was shooting through a window. I didn't realize it was, like, through the wall
and
stuff.
Through the house.
That's
and the fact
more...
that her dad heard noises in the middle of the night.
I guess that would kind of sound... I mean, I don't think I've ever heard a gun going off that...
But he heard something.
Sounding like a door slamming. Like, I can get that. That could be, like, the bullet going through the house.
I mean, it's going to muffle the sound considerably, but...
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, like our page.
Yes. Listen to our episodes.
Listen to our episodes. I think we'll have more.
We aren't going
to
put the word out there fully.
No, because we don't want to jinx it.
But.
But yeah.
We'll be back.
We'll be back.
We will.
And you'll be here, right? And
you'll
be here listening to us ramble on about nothing.
Okay. And pour mega pints.
And pour mega pints.
All right. Well, until then,
keep calm
and spook on.
Bye.